Time for more of the Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, on TalkZone.com.
Our guests are Dr. William Schamber, director of Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philanthropy and Civic Renewal, Dr. Stuart Butler, Heritage Foundation's vice president for domestic and economic policy studies, and Dr. Bernard Gant, Association of Christian Schools International. Stuart, continue your point. You were talking about how someone said, it was I think Alan Patton said that when you take something from someone, it's going to, you have to replace it with something of value.
Absolutely. People want some sense of values and some sense of identity. And if they've lost it for whatever reason, they might have been displaced. They might have been sent somewhere to another country. There could be all kinds of reasons for it. Then there has to be something that takes its place. And if you don't consciously try to do that for particularly troubled younger people, then whoever is a predator ideologically or as a terrorist or whatever is going to take over, is going to take that place. And that's what's so critical. I mean, this is why religion is so important. Religion is, in a sense, and is really an ideology in a very important way, but in a very positive way. And that's what why it's so meaningful for people. And if religious institutions don't engage people, then other forms of ideology take over, and that's what turns people down the wrong road.
It's related to purposefulness and meaningfulness, and that's not exclusive to income or intellect. It's the stuff of relationships, and people are seeking that no matter what income level, no matter what intellectual levels they have, and we're finding that. And I think what this Christmas bombing attempt has demonstrated, that having the intellect, having the income, is no substitute for this thing we call having purposefulness in life or meaningfulness in life. And those who reach an individual and offer them what this meaningful existence, here's how you can have purpose in life. Here's how you can fill this gaping hole in your life. That's what we mean by inspiration. Who inspires you to a purposeful, meaningful existence? And if we're not building those kind of relationships in a positive manner, something else is going to inevitably fill that hole.
Well, we seem to have, I had a fascinating talk with George Dunlap, who was the Undersecretary of Defense at the Pentagon at dinner, and he was saying that for years that his department had been studying some of these interventions that we have been engaged in the inner cities, and he said that George Nye, you know, the author of Soft Power, he was saying that we can never win the war in the Middle East through strictly military intervention. That just bombing people into submission isn't the answer, that we've got to engage the citizenry in the Anbar province and other places. He was saying what they did instead was go in and engage the local tribal leadership to ask them what is it that they prefer to see happen about them. In other words, we spent millions of dollars, for instance, building a huge septic system, a system of sewage system. And we spent millions of dollars with American contractors, but the pipes didn't run to any place. And so what the George and others said they did, they went in and the villagers put together their own system that was local, that was innovative, and that met the needs of the people. They started small businesses. They needed not $1 million plant or others that the Americans had to offer, but instead they needed some capital to buy some chickens, to start a farm and do other things. And when they began to listen to the local tribal leaders and respond to their needs and resource them, then they began to inform the our troops about where there were terrorists hiding and who not to go down that street because there are people waiting to waylay them. And one commander on the, in the field shared with me, she led, I think they call them brigades. She led two brigades, and she said she didn't lose any of her people because they positively engaged the local tribesmen who then were partners with them. They helped them build schools. They helped them do other things they wanted. As a consequence, she said she didn't lose people. But she had a very difficult time convincing her peers to do the same thing because they defined themselves as being military, and military, therefore, is there to do military things, which they defined is suppress, you know?
Yeah, so, it's interesting and ironic that our military is, in fact, sort of the pride of America's technological capacity. I mean, of all places where technology seems to be the primary solution to the problem, it's in our military establishment. And here, as you say, Bob, at the very cutting edge of the most technological institution in America, our military, we find that it isn't sufficient, that, you know, for all the sophistication of electronic eavesdropping and electronic surveillance, for all the sophistication of remote control bombs, that doesn't solve the problem. You do, in fact, need to engage the people in the community to take ownership of their own problems. Otherwise, the solutions that are being delivered to them are viewed as alien solutions. Troops in the village, even though they're there to keep peace, are understood to be alien forces. It's only when the villagers are consulted about their own needs and are encouraged to step forward and address those needs in their own way, that people begin to take ownership of the peace and order in the community, and actually the village begins to calm down. But, you know, just like professional social work tends to overlook the kinds of local groups that you're talking about, a professional military would be very hard-pressed to adopt this solution because it is so unlike the kinds of highly technological applications to which they're accustomed. So it's a real challenge for our military, just as it would be a challenge for our social service professionals, to admit that the tools, the cutting-edge scientific tools that the 21st century have given us, you know, that they just aren't enough, and that you need, in fact, this other kind of soft power that comes from the community up.
But there are parallels between our police, our domestic military, mm-hmm. and they, in fact, apply hard power against those people. See, a lot of people who advocate what we're talking about think we're soft-headed, that we're not for military intervention, that we don't think the police ought to come in and lock people up. That's just not the case. When we had our truce in Benning Terrace, and last show, we had the young people out there talk about how dangerous it was, and the police couldn't solve that problem. It's only when we brought the leaders, 16 of them, to the offices at the center and sat them down and provided them not just prohibitions, but also given them the opportunity to fulfill their own dreams and to work and to start small businesses and to do it peacefully. I remember asking these young people, are there people on either side who would not go along with this? And each of them looked, said, yes, we can name two fellas, on the avenue and two people in the circle who will not come to the table, that they're just not there. I said, well, what's going to happen to them? They said, nothing, because they're not going to defy us. They will go elsewhere to do their dirt, but it won't be in our community. See, for those individuals, they need to be locked up. They need sanctions, and sometimes they will come to themselves in prison. But for the safety of themselves and for others, they need to be locked up. But the fact is that the majority of the young people who were among the most predatory have now, over the past 13 years, have become the most peaceful. And the question I have for you is that people are always saying, where's the evidence? But evidence obviously isn't enough to convince people that we must seek another way. What is the difficulty that policymakers have, both left and right of center, of embracing this civic engagement to resource people like this? What is it that you think is the principal barrier?
I do think that the issue of data is very important. I'm a historian by background. There's lots of areas and periods of history where there isn't a lot of data. And that doesn't mean that you just sit back and say, oh, well, we can't actually sort of figure anything out about those periods. You have to use other methods of discovering and figuring out what actually happened. And I think that's the same. You're putting your finger right on one of the issues with policymakers now. And it's true also in the intelligence area, you know, which has got so much driven now by data analysis rather than people actually going there and figuring out what's going on, the old-fashioned sort of view of intelligence gathering. And I think one of the things we have to do in the policy community is to devise better ways of enabling people from the outside who are not there in the neighborhoods or they're seeing actually what's going on to get a better understanding of why it is that something is successful and how you know it's successful. That can often be stories. It can often be individuals who come out and say what happened to them. There are all kinds of ways of showing success without having data that the Congressional Budget Office can run for you and sort of show you statistical variations and so on. In many cases, that data is not going to exist. And particularly when you're dealing, as you know, Bob, with inner city violence and inner city gangs, they don't tend to keep the kind of data that the federal government, you know, routinely uses. I don't think they use normal tax records and expenditure surveys and demographic figures. I just don't think that goes on. So you have to find other ways. And it's important to persuade policymakers that that's legitimate. Ordinary Americans think it's legitimate. You know, ordinary Americans get information in a whole range of different ways. But somehow in the policy community, a lot of people just sort of stuck in this. If there aren't numbers that a statistician can run for you, then it isn't information.
Right. I agree. The truth of the matter is everybody who makes it has help. You know, we talk about self-made individuals, et cetera. But as been pointed out in several publications, people who have made it and made it in positive ways, meaningful ways, had help along the way. And again, and now we're back at this theme that I'm on, and that is success really, by and large, is the stuff of relationships. It's not discounting personal values and hard work and initiative and all of these other things that we like to point out in the conservative circles. But a key element, with all of that aside, a key element in this is that there was someone who pulled alongside of what we would call a parakletos, someone who pulls alongside of to lend help, to assist along the way. And those kind of things are hard to quantify. It's hard to get the data on that. It becomes mostly anecdotal kind of information, but it's reality. You could point to anybody, and at some point, whether it's a Bill Gates or on down the line, at some point there was someone who pulled alongside and helped.
I was moved by this movie, The Blind Side, which is sweeping the country. In 2020, did a fascinating portrayal of, presented the real family. And like you were saying, Stuart, that's not data, but what it has. Even Sandra Bullock, who played the role of this mother, she said she was moved to take some of the proceeds from the film and start help a charter school. And the family, when they asked him what impact this had on them, it said, well, you know, having this young man in my home, suddenly my family eating dinner together every night to accommodate him. But in the process, it accommodated them. It brought them together. And also, people were calling after the movie and after the 2020 saying they're going to cancel their vacations and take that money, and they're going to go out and try to be a blessing to someone else. So so what the father concluded, there's a lot of pent-up demand for people doing good things and wholesome and helpful things for other people, but we just don't have the means to promote this. It's fascinating. In our market economy, it is driven by competition and innovation. In the early, late 50s, the computer was large and it took up a whole floor of the University of Penn Physics Department. There are two responses to it. We could have subsidized access. But what the market economy does, rather than subsidize access, it supports innovation and competition. And to the point now where today that same intelligence is in a phone. We don't have the moral equivalent in the social economy, where instead of competition, it's called duplication of effort.
Yeah.
In a market economy, we know that there's a Popeyes, there's going to be a Burger King nearby. But in our social economy, we say, no, well, if organization X is performing that service there, well, you can't have another one doing the same thing. And so the question is, how do we begin to insinuate this principle into the economy so that people understand we desperately need innovation and get away from these large computers called social service agencies that suck up all the money? And the same approaches, they just funded $5 million in Chicago to help reduce youth violence, and part of it is to take therapists and bring them into the homes of low-income, at-risk kids to help them with parenting skills. But that's the kind of ridiculous responses that we get now, even in the face of the evidence that we're presenting, Stuart.
Well, I mean, in the market system, you mentioned Bill Gates a little while ago. You don't even need to have a degree in order to be successful in the electronic business. He dropped out of Harvard. Nobody said, well, therefore, you can't become a billionaire. It's not permitted. He just went ahead and did it. Step one is to say it's results that matter, not the credentials that you bring to the table. That's exactly how market works in the economic area, and it should be how it works in dealing with these kinds of issues. And that's why, again, the problem of this desperation for having, you know, people with the right credentials coming in and telling you what to do or how to function reinforces the data issue. And so in both cases, we've got to get away from this formalization, which suffocates exactly the kind of innovative approaches that are necessary today.
We're talking about national security and the role of engaged citizens. And our guests are Dr. William Shambaugh, director of the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philosophy and Civic Renewal, Dr. Stuart Butler, the Heritage Foundation Vice President for Domestic and Economic Policy Studies, and Dr. Bernard Gant of the Association of Christian Schools. I'm Bob Woodson, President of the Center for Enabled Enterprise, and we'll return right after these messages.